So,
I support the proposal before the board today. In particular, new rule 3526 should improve auditor communications with audit committees about independence matters. There's the obvious improvement that we will now require for communication before an auditor is engaged by a company. Perhaps even more importantly, though, I think the new rule does a much better job of articulating the auditor's responsibility to communicate matters that may reasonably be thought to bear on independence. To this end, the communication is not limited to disclosures about relationships that are specifically prohibited by the SEC or other applicable rules. Rather, the point of the communication is to apprise the audit committee of other relationships that, although not specifically prohibited, might be perceived by a reasonable investor to impair the auditor's independence. This rule is intended to foster a thoughtful evaluation of whether such relationships could impair the auditor's independence, regardless of whether the relationship is specifically prohibited. No doubt, a lot of work goes into checking for compliance with applicable independence prohibitions. Companies, including their audit committees, are, of course, responsible for making sure their actions comport with applicable law. But that's not the real point of the oversight of the auditors. Rather, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act made audit committees responsible for the appointment, compensation, and oversight of auditors so that they could apply independent judgment about potential conflicts between the auditor and management, including conflicts that are not addressed explicitly in existing prohibitions. First and foremost, the audit committee's job is to protect the interests of the company's investors. The new rule gives them even better tools to do so. I'm also comfortable with the amendment to Rule 3523. By amending the rule, we are not expressly permitting firms to accept audit engagements in situations where they provided tax services to managers during the period subject to audit. Rather, our rule will no longer expressly prohibit firms from accepting such engagements. Nevertheless, as our release explains, each firm is still required to evaluate whether a reasonable investor with knowledge of all the relevant facts and circumstances would view the firm as capable of exercising objective and impartial judgment on all issues encompassed within the audit engagement. And finally, I would also like to thank the staff for putting this proposal together. A lot of thought and effort went into it, including Tom Rabe, Bill Richmond, Greg Skate, and also Jake Lesser of the General Counsel's Office. The release accompanying these rules in particular provide a thoughtful discussion of the considerations auditors should undertake. Thank you.
Dan. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The recommendations that are before the board today bring us to the end of a long and winding road that began back on December 14, 2004. On that day, the board first proposed a rule to prohibit auditors from providing personal tax services to senior officers who oversee financial reporting at a public company audit client. The idea behind that rule, which has now been largely in effect since mid-2006, remains sound. Auditing a public company and simultaneously assisting its officers with their personal taxes is incompatible with both the fact and appearance of independence. It also carries the potential that the auditor will be caught in the middle if the interests of the audit client and the interests of the officers in minimizing their taxes diverge. Rule 3523 prohibits mixing auditing and executive tax services, and nothing the board is considering today erodes that principle. However, we've also learned a few things during our 3.5-year journey. One is that in framing independence rules, care has to be taken to avoid creating unnecessary obstacles to competition. In its original form, Rule 3523 prevented an audit committee from engaging a new firm to perform the company's audit if that firm had provided tax services for a company financial reporting executive during the early part of the fiscal year to be audited, even though the personal tax work ended before the firm became the financial statement auditor. The amendment to Rule 3523 that we're considering would solve that problem by deleting the reference to audit period from the existing rule. As a result, personal tax services will be required to end when the audit engagement begins, but not before. This change would not compromise the original objective of Rule 3523, and I support it. While we've spent much time and effort on this rather technical issue, resolving it brought to light a second or substantive anomaly in the board's existing rules. The current independence rules, which the board inherited when it adopted the interim standards in 2003, require the auditor to inform the audit committee annually about matters that might bear on the auditor's independence. Surprisingly, however, nothing in those rules says that such a communication should take place before the audit committee decides to hire the auditor. Rule 3526 will address that issue by requiring that, prior to accepting an initial audit engagement pursuant to PCAOB standards, the would-be auditor must inform the audit committee of any present or past relationships with the public company or with its financial reporting executives that may reasonably be seen as bearing on independence. This seems like common sense. The new rule will make sure that audit committees have the relevant independence information in front of them when they select the auditor, not after they've already made the decision and the work has begun. Rule 3526 is broader than Rule 3523 in that Rule 3526 extends to disclosure about any relationship that might reasonably be seen as bearing on independence. However, the two rules do dovetail. Rule 3526 will assure that audit committees are informed in cases where a potential new audit firm has performed personal tax services for financial reporting executives so that that fact can be weighed in deciding whether to engage the firm. In short, while we've been at this task for a very long time, I think we finally ended up in the right place. The process has resulted in an improvement in both the tax services rule and in the rules governing communications with audit committees about independence matters. I'd like to join in thanking, well, both the commentators who helped us to explore the ramifications of these two proposals and also those in the chief auditor's office, particularly Bella Ripshin, who's been with this project, I think, since the beginning, or close to it at least, as well as those in our general counsel's office who've been working on this long-standing effort. With that, I would like to ask a couple of questions just to bring out some points that I think have already been touched on. Let's start with Rule 3526, the rule that requires disclosure about matters that could be seen as bearing on independence. I think you alluded to this, Bella, in your comments. A number of the comment letters raised questions about whether there were legal obstacles to making this kind of disclosure to the audit committee, and in particular, whether there were laws or legal principles that stopped the auditor from informing the audit committee if it was doing tax work for an executive. We didn't make any changes in the proposal in response to those comments. And I wonder, first of all, if an accountant prepares a U.S. federal tax return for an individual who's a financial reporting executive at a company, can they disclose that fact to the audit committee?
I'm going to let our general counsel's office answer that question.
I thought you might.
That is correct. As you mentioned, several commenters did raise potential confidentiality issues in various contexts under Rule 3526, including specifically the context of providing tax services to individuals at the audit client. As discussed more fully in the adoption release before the board today, both the Internal Revenue Code and the IRS regulations do prohibit tax return preparers from disclosing or using a taxpayer's tax return information before obtaining a consent from that person to do so. And tax return information is defined quite broadly in those regulations. Should quickly add here that we are not experts on the tax laws, but I do believe that definition is broad enough to include the name of the individual, that services that have been provided to, and the fact of the engagement itself. So, again, this is an issue that could be overcome with a consent, but is one, as the adopting relief before the board today says, that the board staff will be sensitive to and monitor going forward.
I mean, I'm sensitive to your point that we can't interpret the tax laws, and so I mean, I don't want to press you to give interpretations that aren't really within our field, but I'll proceed a little farther down this road. I mean, could the auditor say, you mentioned that the name of the client for whom a tax return was prepared would be an issue. Could the auditor say, well, we've done tax work for someone who's a financial reporting executive of this company, but we're not authorized to tell you who it is?
Well, again, with a consent, they can, of course, disclose the engagement and the details itself. It's not at all clear that without that consent they could do that type of anonymous disclosure. The regulations are quite broad, and in other contexts at least, prohibit tax return preparers from providing even anonymized type information.
Okay, well, let's talk about the consent then. How easy or hard, or how formal does that consent have to be? Can the individual simply say, well, sure, I have no problem with you telling the audit committee about your work for me?
Well, again, this is an area where both the IRS regulations and other guidance put out by the IRS are quite specific. There is a requirement to consent be written and have certain specified elements. So that is something trust and expect tax return preparers are familiar with. They would have to follow those applicable IRS requirements and that sort of thing.
It's fun to talk about this. I won't talk about it anymore, except to say it's not a problem really created by this rule. The same issues would arise under ISB number one. Do we have any information about whether this is a problem today or how the firms deal with it today?
We do not, to my knowledge. As you said, this could arise under ISB one. I don't believe we've come across information that this is an existing problem. This type of issue could also arise in other contexts. As you pointed out in your remarks, our Rule 3523 has been in effect for some time now, and if a firm uncovered a violation of that rule or had an interpretive question related to that rule and needed to disclose these types of details, the firm would have to face similar legal issues in the course of taking those steps. And again, we'll plan to monitor this issue going forward, but we are not aware that it's surfaced as a problem today.
You might have thought you
go ahead. No, please.
I apologize.
Yep.
Thank you. But the individuals that we're talking about are not just any individual off the street. These individuals would be individuals working for that particular company, key officers. And so the situation would be where a key officer would not be granting a consent to the auditor to provide the information to the audit committee of the company.
That's correct.
So it's not as if it's just a consent that I should say someone should be withholding on a regular basis. In fact, I would find it to be very unusual that that would happen, and I'm not sure what happens to the auditor. I can't speculate that far, but I just want to point out, I don't know that this, although it exists and recognize it, I'm not sure, since these are key officers of the company that we're talking about, that this is, it shouldn't necessarily be a big problem, I hope. Anyway.
See, I said this was an interesting issue. That does provoke another question. Is there anything to stop the audit committee from saying, well, okay, you want to be the CFO of this company? One of the terms of employment is you would have to consent to disclose any relationships you have with the auditor, including whether they prepare your tax return.
Well, I agree with you. That is an interesting question, and I think we've discovered the bounds of my tax law knowledge at this point. That is a question. I do not know whether that would be sufficient under the... Again, the IRS has quite detailed guidance on the consent, and that's a question that doesn't seem to be specifically addressed in that guidance, and I would leave to my colleagues in the tax line.
Okay, thank you. And Bella, you've talked in some detail about this, leaving the words in the auditor's judgment from the description of the matters that have to be disclosed that might bear on independence. I'm just sort of a summary question there. Does the staff see the inclusion or deletion of those words as having any impact on what's actually disclosed? And does it expand or contract the scope of the requirements?
Well, I might just add a different voice to that question. You indicated Bill did touch on that question, and I'd like to speak to it for a moment. Excluding those words, in our view, should help auditors more clearly focus on those relationships that the audit committee should be aware of. I think, as Bill did indicate, the existing independence rules are written in the context of what is important to a reasonable person, to a reasonable investor. So accordingly, the auditor's judgment, and the judgment by the auditor is necessary in this case, the auditor's judgment about what may reasonably be thought to bear on independence must be made in that context. So we believe that omitting that reference to the auditor's professional judgment would clarify the requirement by essentially reminding auditors of the need to focus on the perceptions of reasonable third parties when making those independence determinations, when making those judgments about what should be communicated.
Okay, I agree with what you said, although it's a little different than the answer that I expected. I think you're saying then that perhaps in a subtle way it expands the scope of the requirement because it does require the auditor to focus on what a reasonable third person might think rather than just on what he or she himself might.
Well, in my own view, I don't think it really does have a substantive change because of the fact that the existing independence requirements, one of which is embedded in the auditing standards, does speak to a reasonable third party already. So the auditor's judgment has to be made in that context.
It does, this is a little more simplistic, but it does seem to me that if we put in the standards in the auditor's judgment, everywhere where a judgment is required in the course of auditing, the standards would double in length. So I personally didn't see this as a substantive change in the disclosure requirement. Bill, you also touched on this issue of secondary auditors. Mm-hmm. Hey, first of all, just to keep us on the same page, what do you mean by a secondary auditor?
A secondary auditor would be someone that would assist the primary auditor in performing audit procedures for financial statement audits. And you could have someone, a secondary auditor, that is affiliated with the primary auditor part of a network or the relationship the primary auditor has. Or you could have a secondary auditor that is not affiliated with the primary auditor, that the primary auditor hires to assist them in the audit engagement.
And this is often, although not always, these folks are going to be foreign firms. If we're talking about a U.S. auditor, they're often going to be firms located outside the United States but are involved in some way.
You potentially could have, if you have a global company that has operations outside the U.S., the primary auditor in the U.S. may hire a secondary auditor in that foreign jurisdiction to assist them in performing certain audit procedures.
So what's the bottom line? How is the audit committee going to find out whether these secondary firms have any relationships that might bear on their independence? I assume they do have to be independent on the same terms that the primary auditor.
They do have to be independent. And if the secondary auditor is affiliated with the primary auditor has the responsibility to disclose any of those relationships that may be reasonably thought to bear on independence under Rule 3526, which is similar to how ISB-1 would treat it. Also, as it relates to a secondary auditor that is not affiliated with the primary auditor, we would expect that the primary auditor would explicitly either include those relationships in the communication or explicitly state that it does not do so. So the audit committee would be aware in either case as to the situation.
So the secondary firm ought to be making its own communication to the audit committee.
The secondary auditor is not required to comply with Rule 3526. Only the primary auditor is required to comply with Rule 3526.
So I guess it'd be a good thing for audit committees to ask for on their own, then if it's not explicitly covered.
Yes.
In the rules, at least if they're concerned about the independence, I guess that they should be a unaffiliated secondary firm. Let me turn to Rule 3523. I think you touched on the comments that we got where people expressed concern about the situation where a company is a private company, it has an existing auditor, it decides to become a public company. So the question then arises, well, at what point do we have to stop doing tax services for financial reporting executives of the company. And we have a note to Rule 3523 that answers that question by saying the earlier of when you sign the engagement letter or when you begin the procedures to do an audit pursuant to PCAOB standards. Am I on track?
Yeah.
So far? I guess it would be fairly understandable when you sign an engagement letter. If you're the ongoing auditor, is it going to be clear, well, maybe it says what procedures you have to do in order to transform your existing audits into PCAOB audits? Or in this context, I guess the question is that going to be a clear line of demarcation so that people will know when they have to cut off these tax services for reporting executives?
Well, we recognize that in certain circumstances it might be difficult to identify the when the continuing auditor began the procedures pursuant to the standards of the PCAOB. In the SAS view, the auditor begins the procedures for the purposes of Rule 3523 when the auditor begins the procedure, including the required audit planning procedures to update its earlier audits to conform them to the standards of the PCAOB, or begins procedures on a new audit pursuant to those standards. This point in time will depend on the particular facts and circumstances of the particular engagement and the corporate life event, rather than any specific triggering event that I think could be established by the board in the rule. So the auditor will need to be cognizant of basically their relationship with the client and the communications that they are having with the client regarding the client going pursuing this initial public offering to determine when they start performing those procedures and when they would need to stop performing the tax services.
I guess you said that the planning would be the triggering point, or once they begin concrete planning for the PCAOB.
Yeah.
Just one other thing, something else that people were quite concerned about in the comments were mergers and whether we should have some kind of transition period or guidance about how Rule 3523 impacts the merger situation. And I guess what they're thinking about are two situations. I mean, if A and B merge, and the auditor of A is the auditor of the survivor, when do they have to stop doing any tax work they might be doing for the financial executives of B? And I guess you could have the reverse situation, where the auditor of B becomes the auditor of the surviving company and would have to stop doing tax services for the executives of A. I mean, could you just briefly address how the rule applies to those situations? Again, we haven't made any changes to address those.
Yes, we have not made any changes. In a business combination that results in a change of employer for a person in financial reporting oversight role, for example, from an acquired company to a surviving company, the existing transition period in Rule 3523C would apply. So in your first example, because the individuals that are working for the acquired company, Company B, they would experience an other change of employment event if they became employees of Company A, the surviving company, as a result of the acquisition. If these executives were actually had an engagement for personal tax services in process before the acquisition took place, then the firm would have 180 days allowed under our rule, current Rule 3523C, to complete the tax services for those individuals or transition them to the provider. As a reminder, Rule 3523C provides this 180-day limited transition period to conclude the tax services to a person who was not in a financial reporting oversight role before hiring, promotion, or other change in employment events. And in your example, the first example is that because they go from an acquiring company to a surviving company in terms of employers, that would be considered another change of employment event. And we actually provide a little bit more explanation of this in the questions and answers that the staff issued in April of 2007. Now, talking about your...
So that's just on the situation you just covered, the people at B, it's just as if they just got promoted to become financial reporting executives, or
they
were hired.
Yeah.
They get the
because they changed
the
employers, the auditors would be allowed to have 180 days to complete their tax services that were in process at the time. Now, as it relates to your second example, let's say, same situation, but if the acquirer company's auditor, company B's auditor, is the one that becomes company A auditor. Well, in that situation, you would assume that company B's auditor was providing tax services to company A because they, for those individuals who are not in financial reporting oversight roles. In that situation, because the individuals in a financial reporting oversight role were employed by company A before acquiring company B and stayed employed by company A after the acquisition, Rule 3523 would not apply, and therefore the company B's auditor, although the surviving auditor, would not have 180-day transition period to complete those tax services. We believe this is appropriate because, as discussed earlier in our remarks, the staff does not believe a transition period is necessary to allow a newly engaged auditor to conclude the in-process tax services to persons in a financial reporting oversight role at what would be a change of auditor, so therefore a new audit client. We would hope that because an acquisition or another business combination does not occur overnight, that there would be enough time during that, I guess, that business transaction to complete those services before the company B's auditor officially becomes company A, the surviving company's auditor.
Okay, just one last thing. Maybe it's just me, but it does seem to me that there's some ability to trip over Rule 3523. What do you do if you think you violated the rule? You come to us? Come to the SEC? We have the ability to grant waivers? Do they have the ability to grant waivers? And what happens if you screw up under this rule?
Well, I'm going to let our general counsel's office answer that question.
Try that one as well. And before Spivak responded as well, too, I should point out the board's action today will have the effect of narrowing the scope of Rule 3523, which hopefully should minimize the number of inadvertent violations that do occur under that rule, or situations in which some sort of exemption would be thought to be necessary. That said, if a firm has violated a rule or thinks it needs an exemption, the firm would need to think about its alternatives and its responsibilities in that situation, including its responsibilities to its audit client. While we do have authority under Title II of the Act to grant exemptions on a case-by-case basis and subject to SEC review, it's important to remember that both the SEC and the PCAOB implement independence rules, including specifically enforcing PCAOB independence rules, such as Rule 3523. And the SEC has a dual interest in these matters, because in addition to overseeing auditors, they have responsibility for public companies' filings, and public companies, of course, have an obligation to have their financial statements audited by an independent accountant. Therefore, in practice, when firms do become aware of violations, including a violation of a PCAOB independence rule, it's often the case that they will approach the SEC's Office of Chief Accounting Staff, perhaps in conjunction with the PCAOB staff, about the issue. I can't speak for the SEC specifically about when or under what conditions they would choose not to enforce a violation, but again, by ensuring that both the PCAOB and SEC staff are aware of the issue and involved in the discussion, at least the firm has taken the necessary steps to see that a coordinated resolution of the issue is possible.
Thank you very much.
Any further discussion? If there's no further discussion, I'll put the question to the board. All those in favor of approving the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay? The ayes have it, and the motion is carried. If there's no further business, this concludes our agenda today. The meeting is now adjourned. We will rise in the open meeting and reconvene at 10:35 for the closed meeting of the board. Thank you, and thanks again to Tom, Bella, Greg, and Jake.